bit about that. It was quite...
Well, it was quite an extraordinary moment.
It was. I mean,
this is a group of British settlers. The guy who's a rabbi, the father, used to be a rabbi in a synagogue in London, and he took the whole family out there into an illegal settlement, stolen Palestinian land, and then two of his daughters and his wife were eliminated by the resistance. And you see that little meeting that they have, and the videos are there on social media. And one of them says, well, actually, I think we know your relatives. And he says, no, I don't think you do. And then they have this discussion where it becomes apparent that actually his relatives knew part of his relatives. And it really does illustrate the closeness of these kind of elites who are hostile to power coming from developing countries and challenging Western power. They're really very close to each other, such that their families even know each other. You know, who'd have thought that some kind of, if you like, a random settler family in occupied Palestine would actually have potential family connections to the potential dictator of Iran?
Yes, I'm very curious. State of affairs, I must say. But anyway, I also asked Sir Tora how she thinks the trip to occupied Palestine was received in Palestine and in Iran.
Well, I mean, the majority of the people here hate the Pahlavi family, and they have not forgotten the history of the oppression by this regime, the last dictator in Iran. But it received even more criticism because it happened at a time when inside the occupied territories, the Israeli regime was having problems with its own settlers. Like, the settlers were protesting inside the occupied lands against the Israeli regime. And it was at a time, or right after a time, when there were disputes and unrest inside the occupied territories and against the Israeli regime. So it was like double ironic. And even among Iranian expats, that once a change inside Iran, you could see that they were criticizing him because first he claimed that he represents the Iranian nation, but he does not. Nobody in Iran, not Iranians outside Iran, believe that Pahlavi represents them in any way. But it's also very ironic because he claimed that he's representing in Iran in meeting the Israeli regime officials. And he also forgot that the same Netanyahu that he's praising had previously in a statement in his account of the Bible story was humiliating Iranians and was accusing Iranians of being hostile to the Jewish people, which is not true. I come from a city where we have active synagogues, we have active churches, and obviously active mosques, because it's like the city of Isfahan is known to be the home to Armenian Christians and Iranian Jewish people, and Jewish people have representatives in the Iranian parliament.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, as we've got another report now about Pahlavi's frantic efforts to drum up support.
The temporary Zionist entity appears more and more doomed with each passing week. It is hard to tell which is the more desperate: the pretender to the non-existent throne of Iran, or the faltering occupation of Palestine. Pahlavi is desperate to strut the world stage, pressing his claim to the throne, and to try and gain support anywhere he can, even from the irreducibly racist settler colony. At the same time, his CIA sponsors try and present a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic of Iran. On January the 1st, they published a coordinated message on social media. Reza Pahlavi was joined by CIA stooge Mashi Alinejad and several others, including grassroots activists and president and spokesman of the Association of Victims' Families of Flight PS752, Hamid Eshmaelian. They met collectively in late March in Toronto, but since then their collective has appeared to be shaky, with at least one member leaving. It seems Pahlavi didn't tell the rest of his comrades that he was planning to collude with the temporary Zionist entity. After Palestine, Pahlavi then jetted off to Italy to be greeted with praise by far-right monarchist supporters as he lobbied the far-right Italian government to further punish the people of Iran via sanctions. Meanwhile, in the temporary Zionist entity, hitherto allies seem to be moving away at an alarming speed. The Chinese brokered deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the restoration of diplomatic relations with Syria and Iran by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, the talks between Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey, the possible end of the war in Yemen, even the US is cautious of its traditional ally, are all bad news for the Zionist entity. Pahlavi and the Zionist entity envisage the end of the Islamic Republic, which they hasten to bring about. But the reality is that the Republic is on the multipolar side of history, and the collapse of the unipolar US power will only mean that the liberation of Palestine is hastened from the river to the sea.
Well, I asked Sitara how she thinks the emerging multipolarity is influencing how the world sees Iran and Palestine.
That's true. I think with the attempts to de-dollarize transactions across the world, with attempts to shift from relying on US, from being more self-reliant and being more cooperative with China and Russia as the other superpowers, we are seeing more examples of how nations can now be brave enough, I would say, to stand to the U.S. Balling policies and to figure out a way that works better for their own nation and for the people of the world. This also includes more pressure on the Israeli regime, because as more people and as more nations want their governments, want their states to stand against the U.S., they also want more gestures of rejecting the Israeli apartheid regime and the occupation in Palestine.
David, we just heard in the package there that the CIA's attempt to cobble together a broad opposition movement to the Islamic Republic is faltering. I mean, would you say that Palestine was influential in the fracturing of that coalition?
It would seem so. I mean, it seems that him neglecting to tell his erstwhile colleagues that he was going to Palestine has caused the fracturing to happen. Because, of course, to associate for people in Iran, like the guy from the campaign for the people who were shot down in that Ukrainian aircraft, I mean, that's kind of a red line issue, and that aligning with the Zionist entity is difficult for those in the Iranian opposition, because they're so widely hated in Iran. But let me just say about this Ukrainian airline, I mean, it's a really interesting case. This is people might not remember, it's a Ukrainian passenger airline which was shot down accidentally by the IRGC. Now, this guy is campaigning for the people who were killed in Iran and outside Iran. But, of course, what's just happened in Iran is that the people who were responsible, the military people who were responsible, have just been found guilty in court and sentenced to prison sentences. And it's an extraordinary contrast with countries like the UK or the US, where people who are in power, and the police or the military, really, rarely, if ever, go to jail. And that's a really real contrast. And it shows the difference in Iranian politics and the way in which Palestine might, therefore, have a key role in fracturing a coalition like this, much to the disappointment of the CIA.
Not only do they not go to jail, but people that expose abuses, war crimes,
themselves,
I'm thinking Julian Assange, example, ends up in prison as a political prisoner being tortured.
Yeah,
that's in solitary confinement in Belmarsh while waiting extradition to the US. Well, anyway, I asked Sitara for her thoughts on the divisions amongst this purported unified coalition being presented by the CIA.
Well, these people and these so-called opposition figures had a lot of disagreements from the beginning. And those of us inside Iran who could see through the propaganda, could see the fall and the collapse of this so-called coalition coming very soon. They all agreed that they didn't want the Islamic Republic. But what they did not agree on was what to replace the Islamic Republic with and how to fight in their imagination, the Islamic Republic. They also were so detached from the realities on the ground in Iran that they thought they are reflecting the will power of or what the Iranians actually want, which was not true. I mean, Iranians inside Iran, they, like any other nation, like any other democratic nation, they might have disagreements and dissatisfactions with parts of the functions of the government. And they know how to voice that. They know how to pursue changes. And we have been doing that through our parliament and different government bodies and electing different people into power. But these people just wanted to pursue their own agenda.
David, just remind us really about Mahsa Ahmadinejad and her involvement in directing protests in Iran.
Well, she was one of the leaders of the Women Life Freedom protests. I mean, she lives in New York,
yes.
But she was one of the leaders from there. And of course, her day job is as a paid propagandist by the American government. She works for Voice of America, has received from the American government almost $500,000 in the last eight or 9 years for her work effectively lying about Iran. Mm. Here she is in this coalition as a potential leader of a new government in Iran. Well, you know, everybody knows that this is simply a CIA operative working on behalf of the US government and its interests, and not someone who has any role in thinking about the interests of the people of Iran. And she was one of the ones who tried to pretend that this was all about the hijab and women's rights. But of course, her real demands are increased sanctions, which will only help. Which will only harm the people of Iran as opposed to improving women's rights. So this is an indication, really, of the level of the people who are involved in the opposition.
Mm. Oh, you say everybody knows, but of course some people are indeed duped, aren't they, by the propaganda and think this woman is some sort of heroine. I mean, you know, we see this on social media, don't we?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it's the weaponization of feminism by US imperial power. I mean, you know, we ought to be able to understand that now. It's
yes.
As people say, you ought to be able to walk and chew gum.
Yeah, I mean, no, indeed.
You know, feminism and women's rights are not the same as US imperial power.
Mm. No, absolutely. And this is coming to light more and more, and hopefully people are kind of waking up. But I think people are indeed more and more waking up. Well, anyway, I asked Sitara if she thinks the issue of Palestine is likely to win Pahlavi any friends in the Iranian opposition or elsewhere.
I think so. As I said, he is so detached from the realities on the ground. He hasn't been inside Iran. He has not been working. I mean, he's been sitting there and receiving money from the U.S. government, probably from Iran's and Iranians' frozen assets. He doesn't make any attempt to understand what the Iranians inside Iran actually want. So I would say, yes, I think this came from a very wishful thinking, from a very, it was coming from a very big lack of understanding of what the Iranians actually want. But if he actually even looked back at the history of Iranian support for Palestine, for the Palestinian cause, even during his father's ruling over Iran, he would understand how the Iranian nation has always been supportive of Palestine.
Well, finally, David, I mean, the abundant signs of emerging multipolarity are all around us, aren't they? I mean, does that influence, do you think, how we should interpret Pahlavi's visit?
I think it does. I think that if this had happened 3 months ago or 4 months ago, before multipolarity really gathered pace with the brokering by the Chinese of the Saudi-Iran deal, then we would see it differently. But because we've now seen all of this, and the most recent, of course, is the Saudis cozying up to Hezbollah, which is a truly, truly extraordinary thing. Who would have thought,
absolutely,
even a month ago, that would be on the cards?
Indeed.
And these things are coming thick and fast. And so the changes are all really quite self-evident in a way, but it's not clear how those changes will have an impact. We do know in relation to the Zionist entity, for example, as we've shown in this programme just the other week, that the US is becoming increasingly skeptical of the Zionist entity, and have the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, the CIA psychic, has been funding some of the demonstrations inside Israel, which is extraordinary.
Mm.
So the way in which Pahlavi and the Zionists are putting themselves on the wrong side of multipolarity is an indication, really, of their weakness, because as the power leaches away from the US, they won't have the big bad boy in the corner to be their friend anymore.
Indeed. Well, we're certainly living in interesting times, aren't we? I'm afraid that's it for today's show. I want to thank our guests, Sitara Siddiqui, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Former US President Donald Trump will not testify in writer E. Jean Carroll's civil defamation and battery case against him, after a Sunday afternoon deadline passed without the former president filing a motion to reopen the case. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump rejected his last chance on Sunday, 7th of May, to testify at a civil trial where a longtime advice columnist has accused him of raping her in a luxury department store dressing room in 1996. Donald Trump, a Republican candidate for president in 2024, was given until 5 p.m. on Sunday, 7th of May, by U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan to file a request to testify. But nothing was filed. It was not a surprise. Donald Trump has not shown up once during the two-week Manhattan trial, where writer E. Jean Carroll testified for several days, repeating claims that she first made publicly in a 2019 memoir. She is seeking compensatory and punitive damages totaling millions of dollars. The jury has also watched lengthy excerpts from an October videotape deposition in which Donald Trump vehemently denied raping E. Jean Carroll or even really knowing her. Without Trump's testimony, lawyers were scheduled to make closing arguments on Monday, with deliberations likely to begin on Tuesday, 9th of May. After plaintiffs rested their case on Thursday, Trump attorney Joe Tacopina immediately rested the defense case as well as without calling any witnesses. He did not request additional time for Donald Trump to decide to testify. Joe Tacopina declined in an email to comment after the deadline passed on Sunday, 7th of May. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan had given Donald Trump extra time to change his mind and request to testify. Though the judge did not promise he would grant such a request to reopen the defense case so Trump could take the stand. At the time, Judge Lewis Kaplan noted that he'd heard about news reports on Thursday in which Donald Trump told reporters while visiting his golf course in Doonbeg, Ireland, that he would probably attend the trial. Trump also criticized Judge Kaplan, a Bill Clinton appointee, as an extremely hostile and rough judge who doesn't like me very much. On the witness stand, E. Jean Carroll, 79 years old, testified that Donald Trump, 76 years old, raped her in spring of 1996 after they met at the entrance of the Midtown Manhattan department store Bergdorf Goodman. She said the encounter began as a fun and flirtatious outing, as Trump coaxed her into helping him shop for a gift for another woman. She said they ended up in the store's desolate lingerie section, where they teased each other to try on a see-through bodysuit. As E. Jean Carroll recorded, laughter accompanied them into the dressing room, where Donald Trump became violent, slamming her against the wall and trying to sexually assault her. In his deposition, Donald Trump said E. Jean Carroll made it up. He called it a false, disgusting lie delivered by a nutjob who was trying to stoke sales of her book. He also repeated comments he made in statements that she was not his type. "She's not my type, and that's 100% true," he said. And he repeated his claims in a 2005 Access Hollywood video in which he bragged that men who are celebrities can sexually assault women. "Historically, that's true with stars," he said. E. Jean Carroll sued Donald Trump in November, minutes after New York State enacted a law allowing adult sexual assault victims to sue others even if the attacks occurred decades ago. E. Jean Carroll's attorney, Roberta Kaplan, wrote a letter to the judge on Sunday to complain that Donald Trump still has not removed April 26 post on his social media network in which he called Carroll's allegations a made-up scam. And she noted that he repeated disparaging remarks about the trial 3 days ago in Ireland. After the 26th of April posting on Truth Social, Judge Kaplan, who is not related to E. Jean Carroll's lawyer, said Trump's comments were highly inappropriate and expressed concern that Donald Trump was trying to communicate to the jury about stuff that has no business being spoken about. The US national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump will not testify in writer E. Jean Carroll's civil defamation and battery case against him after a Sunday afternoon deadline passed without the former president filing a motion to reopen the case. The two sides each rested their cases on Friday after Donald Trump declined to testify in his own defense, but Judge Lewis Kaplan gave Donald Trump until Sunday, 7th of May, to reconsider. Setting an afternoon deadline for Trump to file a motion to reopen the case for the sole purpose of testifying, in light of remarks that Donald Trump made while golfing in Europe, suggesting he would return to New York to confront his accuser. E. Jean Carroll, who brought the lawsuit in November, alleges that Donald Trump defamed her in his Truth Social post by calling her allegations a hoax and a lie, and saying, "This woman is not my type," when he denied her claim that Trump raped her in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the 1990s. The former Elle magazine columnist added a charge of battery under a recently adopted New York law that allows adult survivors of sexual abuse to sue their alleged attacker regardless of the statute of limitations. Donald Trump has denied all the allegations that he raped E. Jean Carroll or defamed her. Each side is expected to deliver closing statements on Monday. The judge is then expected to charge the jury on Tuesday, 9th of May, followed by the start of deliberations. This month's trial is taking place as Donald Trump seeks the White House for a third time, while facing numerous legal challenges related to the 6th of January Capitol attack, his handling of classified material after leaving the White House, and possible attempts to interfere in Georgia's 2020 presidential election.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance. May 13, 1984. Place: Husseiniyah Jamaran, Tehran. Subject: Methods of Islamic Invitation. After the Messenger of Allah, peace be upon him and his progeny, who observed that in time the Imams of the Muslims, peace be upon them, were under hard pressure of Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas. Yet they communicated their subject to people as much as possible. Even in their supplications, if you study the supplications of Imam Sajjad and other Immaculate Imams, you see that they brim with advance to prepare people for higher stations, which are beyond the grasp of ordinary people.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, what we do in this program is to recite some sentences and parts of speech of the great leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. We also try to speak about the meaning and interpretations of these sentences. Today, we want to talk about the concept of self-building from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh's point of view. About this topic, he said, "We cannot reform our country unless we first reform ourselves." This sentence shows the significance of self-building for the person first and then for the society. A human being processes different kinds of selves, namely the self related to the physical body, the self related to the animal instincts, and human self. You know, the most valuable and precious self is the human self, what we made human beings as vicegerents of God upon earth has distinguished man from other creatures. And this is the heavenly spirit, which leads to change human souls. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh here is in fact referring to this ability of human soul to build itself. Imam Ali alayhi salam said in that regard, "Man arafa sharafa ma'nahu wa sanahu 'an dana'ati shahwatihi wa zuri munah." Whoever discovers the nobility of the self shall guard him against lowness of passions and false desires. So you see that the first step to build the self is in fact to discover its nobility and value. Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. When the individual discovers the true value of his or her soul, then he or she would try to solve and compensate for the shortcomings of the self. The important point Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh made in here is that after a person tries in that way to build himself or herself, the manifestation of this action would be seen in the society, and in that way the whole society will become safe and sound. So, do not underestimate the power of self-building and its effect to the society. When everybody tries to see his or her own faults instead of others, they will try to make themselves a better person, and along with that, they will help one another in the process of self-correction, and that is very important. That is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh emphasized on both processes of self-correction and reform in the society.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing a backlash from his own party after hundreds of Tory councillors lost their seats in local elections. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story. In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing a growing backlash after he suffered a disastrous set of local elections as hundreds of Tory councillors lost their seats. The Prime Minister admitted the results were disappointing, but said he did not believe there had been a massive groundswell of movement towards the Labour Party. While Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer declared that his party's fantastic results showed that Labour was on course to win the next general election, some pollsters said Sir Keir Starmer had not done enough to be confident of outright victory. Meanwhile, Sir Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrats' leader, refused to rule out joining the Labour Party in a coalition if there is a hung parliament. As of 2:30 a.m. in the early hours of Saturday morning, 6th of May, the Conservatives had lost 960 councillors and lost control of 48 councils, while the Labour Party had gained 635 seats and gained 22 councils. The Liberal Democrats had gained 12 councils and 416 councillors. With all but two seats declared, the Conservatives were on a total of 2,287 councillors and 33 councils, while Labour were on 2,652 councillors and they controlled 71 councils. And the Liberal Democrats, with 1,615 councillors, were in control of 29 councils. On Friday, 5th of May, in what the Liberal Democrats called the Portillo moment of the election, the party took control of Michael Gove's local council of Surrey Heath. Sir Ed Davey's party are hopeful of taking a swathe of blue wall seats from Tory heartlands at the next general election. Other prominent Conservatives with Surrey seats include Jeremy Hunt and Dominic Raab. A party source said Liberal Democrats have won big in Michael Gove's backyard of Surrey Heath, taking control from the Conservatives. This is the Michael Portillo moment of these local elections. Senior Conservative cabinet members are now looking nervously over their shoulders at the Liberal Democrats. Also on Friday, 5th of May, Labour overtook the Conservatives to become the largest party in local government in Britain. They now have more seats than the Tories across England. As well as illustrating the party's strength across the country, it means they will take control of the local government association. Labour snatched seats from the Tories in the Red Wall in the north of England, and the Lib Dems took seats in the southern Blue Wall. The Tories lost Medway to Labour, who will run the Kent Council for the first time since 1988, with the outgoing Conservative Council leader telling No. 10 Downing Street to get their act together on multiple fronts. The Conservatives also lost Stratford-upon-Avon, the seat of Naveem Zahawi, the former Chancellor. Also to go were Hertsmere district of Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, and Welwyn Garden City and Hatfield, the area of Grant Shapps, the Energy Secretary. Labour gained the totemic Red Wall Council of Stoke-on-Trent, as well as winning Plymouth, along with Middlesbrough Mayor. Hailing the results, Sir Keir Starmer said Labour blew the doors off in places such as Medway, adding, "Make no mistake, we're on course for a Labour Party majority at the next general election." Rishi Sunak is facing a growing backlash after preemptively blaming the losses on the box set drama that engulfed the Conservatives during the premierships of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, instead of addressing the party's current problems. Responding to the results, Rishi Sunak said, "It is always disappointing to lose hard-working Conservative councillors. I'm not detecting any massive groundswell of movement towards the Labour Party or excitement for their agenda. What people want us to do is focus on their priorities." Hugh Merriman, a transport minister, said constituents were complaining to him about older news about former prime ministers. Asked if the poor showing was Boris Johnson and Liz Truss's fault, Hugh Merriman said, "Certainly on the doorstep, the feedback I got was that we are in a better place. The opinion polls show, they show that as well, people are reacting in a more positive way towards Rishi Sunak." But one Conservative source said, "Rishi Sunak can't blame these results on last year's chaos. He started that chaos by knifing the most successful Tory election winner in the past 50 years. Sunak's claim that stability has been restored is shot to bits. These results are on track to be catastrophic for the Conservative Party and worse than before the change of leader." Others demanded he change policies if he is to have a chance of winning the next election. Sir John Redwood, the former cabinet minister, called for an emergency budget. He told The Telegraph, "Disillusioned Tory voters just don't think we care about them. The endless tax attacks with everything from motoring taxes to VAT on fuel to the stealth taxes on income are deeply unpopular. People are very unhappy with the lack of progress so far, lack of progress on growth, on inflation, on taxes and on migration." Sir Christopher Chope, the MP for Christchurch since 1997, added, "My view is we can't carry on like this. We need to change direction and make it clear to people what we stand for." Another Tory MP urged Rishi Sunak to go beyond managerial competence to set out his vision, while a fourth added, "When you do worse than your top loss prediction, something's gone badly wrong." Newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. "What I'm hearing on the doorstep is that people are giving Rishi Sunak a chance," the Conservative Party chairman, Greg Hands, insisted in the face of a disastrous night for the Conservative Party. Among Conservative MPs with positive spin on the loss of hundreds and possibly as much as 1,000 Tory seats was not going down well on Friday. Some have even bluntly admitted the terribleness of the results. Johnny Mercer, the MP for Plymouth Moor, where Labour gained the local council, gave the most direct admonition to his party that it would need to learn from this and make a material difference to the quality of people's lives. "What Rishi Sunak will need to worry about in the short term to medium term is whether his backbenchers are prepared to give him time to turn things around in the face of an increasingly likely general election win for Labour. If the view takes hold that a Labour victory against Rishi Sunak is inevitable, some Conservative MPs will in effect throw in the towel, take on second jobs and mentally check out of politics for the next year." One Tory MP with a relatively safe southern seat said his main reaction was mulling his own private sector job options, given his lack of appetite for a stint in the opposition. But others will want to put up a last-ditch fight, either by attempting to oust Rishi Sunak or pushing his politics towards their own ideological leanings that they think will be more successful with the electorate. In Prime Minister's favour, The only credible candidate as a replacement is Boris Johnson, who was ousted just 12 months ago by his MPs over an avalanche of scandals from Partygate to failure to deal with sexual harassment within his government. Certainly, there is a circle of diehard Boris Johnson fans congregating around the newly formed Conservative Democratic Organisation, or CDO, presided over by the donor Peter Cruddas and backed by the former Home Secretary Priti Patel. David Campbell Bannerman, a former Tory MEP and chair of the Conservative Democratic Organisation CDO, told BBC that it was not a case of bringing back Boris Johnson, but that the party should not rule that out as an option in the long term, as so many members and the public still like him. David Campbell Bannerman later hardened his line, calling for a confirmatory vote of members for Rishi Sunak, adding, It was MP self-preservation that got rid of Boris Johnson. They thought they'd be better off without him. And now it's going to be MP self-preservation getting him back again. We're well adrift, and I'm afraid that it has been because Boris Johnson has been brought down with all the turbulence that resulted from it, and Rishi Sunak is in the frame for that. A Conservative source, not from the Rishi Sunak wing of the party, said, Sunak can't blame these results on last year's chaos. He started that chaos by knifing the most successful Tory election winner in the past 50 years. Sunak's claim that stability has been restored has been shot to bits. These results are on track to be catastrophic for the Conservative Party and worse than before the change of leader.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the role of the Iranian parliament in Iran's foreign policy with the spokesperson for the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of the Iranian parliament, Dr. Abulfazl Amoui. But first, this brief analysis.
According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the legislative branch, called the Islamic Shura Majlis, plays an important role in foreign policy and has to ratify any treaty or agreement that creates any obligations or expenditures for Iran. In this context, the Majlis has a supervisory role over the executive branch ministries involved in foreign affairs, particularly the Foreign Ministry, which is legally obligated to report regularly about its activities to the Majlis. Like all executive branch cabinet ministers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs has to be confirmed by the Majlis before taking office and can be removed by the Majlis if deemed not to be performing up to standard. The Majlis also has its own mechanisms of parliamentary diplomacy, a prominent example being the many bilateral parliamentary friendship groups it maintains with other legislative bodies from around the world, as well as diplomacy related to the Islamic and Asian parliamentary unions. As the historic example of the JCPOA and the current examples of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as Iran's likely future accession to the BRICS Plus shows, no international agreement is deemed legal under Iranian law until it's confirmed and ratified by the Majlis. This is in contrast to the rubber-stamp parliament that existed during the Pahlavi dynasty, which, despite some members objecting, could not even prevent the British from forcing the ruling monarch of the time to concede any claims to Bahrain during the British retreat from the Persian Gulf in 1971. Bahrain historically being Iranian territory occupied by the British when they entered the Persian Gulf in the early 19th century. Contrary to the distorted picture painted by Iran's enemies, the legislative branch, as the direct representative of a cross-section of Iranian society from all ethnic and regional backgrounds, plays an integral part in the foreign policy decision-making of Iran, and is in fact one of the greatest sources of power and credibility for the Islamic Republic in its defense of Iran's national interests and projection of power around the world, together with the executive branch, the security services, and the Supreme National Security Council. As the global order is rapidly creating new constellations and new alliances, the Islamic Shura Majlis will continue to supervise the activities of the executive branch and defend Iran's national interests as is determined under the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, and will be a source of political power for Iran on the international scene.
Dr. Abulfaz Amoei, spokesperson for the National Security Committee of the Iranian Parliament. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight today. We've come to the Majlis here to speak with you about the role of the Parliament, of the Iranian Parliament, of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy. As you know, and as our viewers have seen, we have done a series of programs with the different members of the foreign policy team as it relates to the foreign ministry. Today we thought it might be good to look at these issues from the perspective of the parliament. So we would like to ask you to please give us some insight first into the role of the Iranian parliament, of the Islamic consultative assembly in the larger context of Iranian foreign policy, where it becomes involved, those places that are particularly important to the Majlis. And then later we can discuss some of the other subjects specifically that you are working now on in the Majlis. So if you could please, with your permission, if we could start our conversation with you, giving us a little bit of an insight, a little bit of an explanation for our viewers who are the global audience who might not be familiar about the role of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy.
Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Mr. Torabi, for this interview. The parliament is the legislative body of our country, and it pursues two main duties. One is legislation, specifically in foreign policy. The approval of our country's international obligations takes place in the Majlis, or parliament. The second duty of the parliament in Iran is supervising the performance of executive bodies, part of which is defined in foreign policy. Therefore, the parliament has the opportunity to invite the foreign minister and officials involved in foreign affairs on various occasions. At a higher level, the representatives can raise a query to any minister, or if they recognize that an issue requires a more serious reaction, it may even reach the stage of impeachment from the replies and explanations of the ministers, as well as confirming or rejecting it by the representatives. For this reason, the parliament is generally involved in all the country's issues. It has the power to receive answers and raise questions with the country's executive branch. This is also manifested in foreign policy. In addition, parliamentarians, as representatives of the people of our nation, also perform two other duties. One is the stances they take, part of which is the collective stance which takes place in the form of statements. It is customary that the Iranian parliament and the representatives give their opinion on a joint issue, particularly foreign affairs, by signing a statement. The statement is more of a position declaration. It is non-binding, but it is an act that happens in foreign policy. Another part of the Majlis's duty in foreign policy is pursuing the issue of parliamentary diplomacy. You are well aware that parliaments, along with governments, have started their foreign relations for years. A complementary aspect of formal diplomacy is pursued in parliamentary diplomacy. This is also customary in our parliament. We follow it in our bilateral relations with other countries' parliaments, and I can specifically say that we have a parliamentary friendship group with more than 70 parliaments in the world. That is, the countries that have declared their readiness, a number of representatives who are interested in strengthening relations with that country, become members of the friendship group. A friendship group will be created in that other country as well. These two friendship groups establish relations and support issues that are of common interest to the two countries, and the people's representatives are interested in them. They try to push their governments towards enhancing cooperation with the influence they have on executive organizations, or if there are controversial issues, they can move forward these relations, which are popular rather than formal. That is, these representatives pursue what they think is in the interest of their people through mutual relations in friendship groups. There is another aspect in parliamentary diplomacy. That is the issue of attending international parliamentary assemblies, the most important of which is the International Parliamentary Union, IPU, which dates back to more than 120 years and is among the oldest international institutions. The Islamic Republic of Iran and Iran's Majlis is part of this organization. An assembly is held biannually. A delegation of 15 Iranian MPs from a committee that examines the IPU's meetings and related individuals participate in this committee and express the positions of Iran's Majlis. International parliamentary assemblies are not just IPU. We have the Parliamentary Union of Islamic Countries, PUIC, where Iran's Majlis plays an effective role. We are a parliament that hosts the secretariat of this organization in Tehran. Another assembly that exists between the parliaments is APA, Association of the Asian Parliaments. This union was established by the initiative of Iran between the Asian countries' parliaments, and its secretariat is also in Tehran. There are other assemblies that we are present in as Iran's Majlis. We participate in decision-makings and declare our position and play a role in parliamentary diplomacy. As a result, Iran's Majlis plays a role in foreign policy alongside the government, alongside departments such as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Supreme National Security Council. But beyond that, it also plays a role in determining foreign policy macro strategies, which is mostly about supervising the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and approving international laws and treaties, which must take place in Iran's Majlis according to the Constitution.
So it's interesting. You're saying that in Iran, given the system, the political system that exists, whatever decisions are being made, whatever treaties are being signed, whatever agreements, formal agreements that are being made, they all have to be ratified by the parliament, and this is something that is required by the Constitution. Is this, have I understood you correct?
Yes. According to Article 129 and 135 of the Constitution, any treaty that the Islamic Republic of Iran joins, which the negotiation process and its accession is generally carried out by the government and sometimes specifically by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, must be approved by Iran's Majlis as well. Therefore, all the treaties that are binding, that is, create an obligation for our country to take an action or pay a financial cost or provide a space for another country, all of these must have the approval of the representatives of the Iranian people. Without the approval of the Iranian nation's representatives, these treaties cannot be implemented. And for this reason, Iran's Majlis has a decisive role in accepting or rejecting international commitments.
Okay, so let's look at some examples, because this is very interesting that you're mentioning this. Some people might not realize that this is the way it works in Iran, that it's a full-fledged system where you have these checks and balances between the different branches of government. And as you said, it's a complementary role that the Majlis plays with the executive branch. We have, of course, the example of the nuclear talks about the JCPOA, and also this is more of a historic example. Also, recently we have Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and in the future it looks like we'll be joining the BRICS organization as well. So if you could talk about these three examples that we talked about, the nuclear talks, the JCPOA, the ongoing nuclear talks, that we saw that, for example, the foreign minister talked about the time for these talks is not unlimited. There might come a time when the Majlis will decide that it's no longer needed for Iran to have those discussions with the U.S. But also the recent accession to the Shanghai Organization, as you said, it creates certain responsibilities for Iran if they want to join it, and also in the future for BRICS. So if you could please give us some insight in these three examples.
I will start with the topic of Shanghai, so I can point out an example of Majlis's role. Well, our government has adopted a new approach in which it has put strengthening relations with Asia and Eurasia countries on the agenda. This approach is also supported by the parliament. That is, the Majlis's general view is close to that of the government in this sense. In practice, this opportunity was provided for the Islamic Republic in the past year that after applying for membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, our Ministry of Foreign Affairs negotiated with the secretariat of this organization and reached a document based on which Iran became a member of this organization. Well, joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization requires that the 45 documents which have been approved so far in this organization start their approval process in the new member country. In the same framework, we received a bill from the government a few months ago, which after reviewing them, the government proposed to the parliament to inspect these 45 documents and to ratify them if it finds them in Iran's national interests. Well, this matter was referred to the National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian Parliament. We reviewed these documents. We invite experts from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, military and security institutions during the review process. We listen to their opinions. We study the documents. We invite the Parliament's own research institutions, including the Research Center, to give their opinions. The MPs receive the opinion of the experts who are in touch with the Majlis, and this issue is first examined in the Commission. In the National Security Commission, this matter was approved after the investigations and discussions we had with the officials of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and other officials that I mentioned, and after the Commission approves the matter and voting takes place in favor of it, the matter will be brought to an open session of the Majlis. This means that all the 290 members of the Iranian parliament have the right to comment on it and debate it. Well, regarding this Shanghai document, which was received by the government in the form of two bills, we discussed both of them in an open session within 1 or 2 months. The commission presents them as a specialized body of the parliament. It says that the government has given us this bill. We have reviewed it and considered its details. The Commission's opinion is to accept these documents, to confirm the commitments in these documents as the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, after discussing the pros and cons, if there were any pros and cons, this matter was examined and both of these documents were approved last month. And in fact, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iran's Majlis, accepted to abide by these commitments on behalf of the entire people of the Islamic Republic. Due to the benefits that membership of this organization has for us, we mutually accept these commitments, and that is when the government is allowed to submit a letter addressed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that we have accepted the commitments mentioned in the Shanghai Cooperation's documents. And this process has now taken place. Our government has announced to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the organization has also informed the other members of the organization, and accordingly, the process of accepting Iran's membership is being completed.